Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Native Plant Podcast. I'm your host, John McGee, coming to you live from the international headquarters of McGee Design here in beautiful Middleburg, Virginia on a very, very chilly night. And I'm joined by my partner in crime, my co-host, my best buddy, Mr. Mike Berkeley.
Hey, John. How you doing? It's freezing here. Are you? Is it cold up there in Washington, D.C.?
My God, it's cold. It is cold
it's
tonight.
Freezing down here. We're going to have to talk a lot because that's the only way I'm going to stay warm. We're getting into single digits. Now, and I know, you know, this podcast is going to go all over the place. And you know, people in Wisconsin are going to be laughing at me saying, it's cold here. But, you know, you got to understand, I'm a Southerner, and we don't get cold. You know,
no.
You know, you got single digits. Shoo-wee. Wind chill down close to zero. Oh man, that's correct. This is Tennessee.
Well, you know, I grew up a Yankee, so cold is a relative thing to me, but I have lived south of the Mason-Dixon line like yourself now for 25 years. And yeah, I'm done with the cold. You know, if it doesn't get cold again, I'm okay.
John, and I've heard it in your voice, you know, since I've known you for years now, is that you're starting to slow down and put extra syllables in, you know, like, hey, you know, that's the Southern thing starting to get you.
Well, you know, I like to adapt to my surroundings, and I love it here south of the Mason-Dixon, I gotta say. But, you know, tonight, Mike, we don't have a guest because this is our first show, and I thought it'd be kind of appropriate if you and I just kind of interviewed each other and kind of talked about kind of where we came from and, you know, how did we get into this whole crazy thing that we do. And so with that, I guess I'll throw out the first question. You know, where did this start for you? Where'd you get into gardening? And, you know, second off, were you always into native plants, or was it more of a gardening thing and then natives came later?
Yeah. I mean, think about it, John. You know, I'm old enough to remember it. You know, when someone said native, it meant that you lived in a certain spot a very long time. But as far as native plants, I mean, nobody talked about it back. I'm a child of the 60s, and I can let you just imagine what all that meant. But, you know, my mother was a single parent family going on, and she was very adamant about getting her two boys into the outdoors. And she would take us camping, which is fun, you know, for us. You know, any kind of sound that we would hear at night, you know, that's crazy, you know. And but you know, I think at that early age, I had a whole new appreciation of everything green. I had no idea where I was going to go with it, but I like trees. My mother told me that when I was a real young kid that I would eat bark off of hack trees. and my brother ate cigarette butts, so I'm glad I ended up with them.
You got the better end of the deal there. Yeah.
And the kid next door, you know, he ate dirt. You know, of course, we had all kinds of jokes about the mud pies, but I ate bark off of hackberries. You know, at least I picked a native tree to chew on. But, you know, mom got me into it. And then I got into scouts, and that was huge. Because the Boy Scouts, of course, you learn, and you were in scouts too, right, John?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. And you know, you learn about different values. You know, what's important out there to protect the wild and everything. And of course, back then, you know, there was this environmental movement that happened right after all that. You know, it was really in the scouts. It's like, okay, protect all things natural out there.
Right.
You know, and that was huge. So I would say it was, you know, mom foremost. She got me into, get out into the wild. And state of Tennessee is so diverse. We went to so many places, mostly state parks, some national parks. You get up into the mountains in East Tennessee, you get down towards Memphis and in the lowlands, and you look at bald cypress, and down there. And, and, you know, she really, and of course at the time, I didn't know what they were. I was curious, but, so yeah, mom really got me into it and then followed up with the Boy Scouts. And what about you? How far back? Were you into natives since?
Well,
a child.
No. You know, I was into gardening from a very young age because, I had a great grandmother who, and she wasn't my great grandmother, she was my grandmother, but she was really good about gardening. I had a fantastic grandmother. How's that?
There you go.
Yeah. Grandma Bender. You know, my mom's maiden name is Bender, and, Grandma Bender was, you know, my grandparents had a working family farm. You know, my grandfather was one of those classic guys that worked 17 different jobs and was the mayor of the town and, you know, just a hard working guy. And my grandmother still must have been the person who ruled the roost at home though, because she had a really big peony and iris garden it was kind of all underneath her apple orchard. And you know, as kids, we used to climb those apple trees and we just had a blast out there in the garden. And grandma made sure that all of us, while we were out there, got to know the plants in her garden and what it was to cultivate plants. And so, you know, I come from a big Catholic family and we have, you know, 80, 100 cousins. I don't have any idea what the last count was, but,
100 cousins.
Oh,
man.
Well, you know, my mom had 10 brothers and sisters, and then of course they were all required to have 10 kids, and you know, my family only had 3 kids, and so when we would go to family reunions, I always thought that my parents hated us for some reason. They just wanted to stop at 3. You know, that's it. No more Rosemary. But yeah, you know, my grandma was a big influence. And then I think also when I was a little kid, maybe 4 or 5 years old, my parents bought me a subscription to Ranger Rick, you know, the magazine that the National Wildlife Federation puts out. And that really hit a chord with me, because here was this really cool raccoon that, you know,
he was a cool raccoon.
Yeah, he still is. He's still a good friend of mine now. As you know, we take care of the headquarters of the National Wildlife Federation now, and I can't tell you how thrilled I am every time I go there. I'm just, you know, and I tell them all the time, yeah, you're the reason why I got into nature. And, you know, the editor of Ranger Rick is a client and a friend of mine, and I've told her that story, and she tells me that she's heard that story 100 million different times from different people. So obviously a good magazine if, you know, you have kids and you want to get them into nature. So.
Yeah, because, I mean, how can you not like a raccoon that looks like that?
Yeah.
You know, the Beatles wrote a song about the Ranger Rick raccoon.
Ranger raccoon. Walked into the room. But how about natives, Mike? Were you always always into natives?
Again, just in the past 20 something years, it natives been really getting more into the forefront. And but I guess the native world, it was I went back to school as an older student, returned back to school. Went to Middle Tennessee State University, and speaking of Ranger Rick, I wanted to be a park ranger.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized, well, that there's a certain amount of law enforcement in park ranger. I said, well, wait a minute, that's not really what I want to do. And then forestry, and then I figured out, well, forestry means that you grow trees so you can cut them down. And, and I said, wait a minute, well, that's not what I want to do. So I just got into plant soil science, got into horticulture, and with botany as a minor, and I thought, okay, well, that's where this goes. And that turned out to be a big turning point in my life, because I could take the horticulture side, which is not necessarily all native, you know, learning about soils and you know, how to grow things, you know, things like that. But the botany part was to learn how to key out plants. And okay, so now I can go out into the wild, where when mom would take us, you know, camping, or the Boy Scouts would get us out there in the woods. Now I can figure out what these plants are by keying them out. So that was the botany side. But in the horticulture side, I met to this day, a real good friend is Larry Sizemore. Worked for him at the MTSU greenhouse. He was the greenhouse manager, and he just retired, by the way, after 42 years of being there. And,
wow.
And he taught me two and very important things is, number one, you know, the importance of plants in landscaping. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, the botany side taught me about plants out there in the wild. And then the, you know, working with Larry taught me about, you know, the, you know, what do you do with them if you, you install and put them in your yard? And then the other part was he taught me how to grow. And to this day in this nursery, I still fall back on a lot that I learned from him. But at that time, I started understanding natives. Okay. And why, you know, the funny thing is that if those plants out there and in the wild, you know, for thousands of years. And, you know, you and I, John, we walked out into these woods and said, God, that's some beautiful plants. Well, why are they not in our backyards?
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think that was that blend, you know, at, Middle Tennessee State University is that, you know, how do you put these two together? How do you take horticulture and, you know, figuring out what those natives are out there that are so beautiful? And you put these two together.
Yeah.
Why not? You know, and then right after that, got a retail job at the garden center at More and More Garden Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And met Paul Moore. And you know Paul. He's
I do. Good friend of ours.
Yeah. Good friend of ours. Amazing, photographer. And,
absolutely.
Took a lot of photos of some of those natural areas. He loved going up to Big South Fork, natural recreation area, which is up on the Cumberland Plateau, southeast Kentucky, going into the eastern part of Tennessee, and he would take photos of boulders with covered in moss, and you know, these fern fiddleheads coming up side of it, and wildflowers off to the side, and so, man, that's some beautiful stuff right there, you know. And so when I came to work for him, the first day I walked in for the interview, notice a sourwood off to the side that he was selling.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, you know, I know what that tree is, an outstanding tree. You don't see that tree, or back then you didn't see that tree, in a retail spot.
Ever,
and
figured
out that, you know, Paul was into the natives. And he says, you know what, here's what I want you to do, Mike. I want you, I'll hire you, you know, to sell these plants. We're going to start selling more natives. And I said, really? Because, you know, you go into any mainstream garden center, box stores, and you're not going to see them. You know, back then, you didn't see the natives, you know, represented. And, you know, you saw the burning bush, you saw Bradford pears, one of my favorite trees.
Oh, I saw a bunch of those today, man. I was going crazy.
Oh, man, did you? Oh, cut them down. And, you know, he was gutsy. He says, okay, I'm going to sell something that I feel like we need to sell, even though the public was not asked for it. So, you know, what we had to do was, the big thing was to find them, you know, and that's when I realized, well, no, gosh, no, there's not enough nurseries out there growing them, especially locally.
Right.
And then also we had to educate the, you know, public about it. You know, people know burning bush. They know Nandina domestica. They know the daylilies and the bearded iris and, you know, the peonies and
the
grandmother. Through, you know, Laribi. Oh man, my favorite ground cover. You know, so, you know, that was pretty a gutsy call. So kudos to Paul and, you know, to have that guts. And so I learned how, you know, okay, first off, we got to figure out how to get them and then learn how to promote them. And marketing, as you well know, the marketing of these natives is a little different because you are talking about plants that people don't normally see in their backyard, in typical suburbia. So,
and isn't, you know, that weird? Isn't that odd?
It is weird. It is odd. I mean, I don't understand it. I mean, you know,
never understood.
You
know,
you understand though that it is you can't ram this stuff down people's throat.
Right.
You can't. You have all, you know, all those designs that, and you, gosh, John, I've seen some of your designs that are just absolutely spectacular. And, you know, you're gentle, you know, with those, your clients, you know, you can't ram this down their throats, you know. And I've always said this, you know, you can talk about somebody's mother. You can maybe even talk about their dog, but don't you dare insult their landscape.
No.
Because if you start talking talking about their yard, it's like, wait a minute. Don't tell me what I can and cannot do. This is my kingdom. This is my domain. Get out of my yard.
Yeah.
So, you gotta show them that they're beautiful. You gotta show them that they're tough. They bring in the birds and butterflies and, you know, all the things that we kind of take for granted now. You know, you've done that. So, what about your, where was the big native thing for you and, you know, people that got you into the natives?
Well, you know, similar to you, in high school, I was in I was a Boy Scout, like you're saying. I just was in the Boy Scouts for fun and to go camping. And then, while you're out there camping, of course, you know, like you've said to me, you know, there's a sassafras tree and suddenly you can, the scoutmaster's teaching you to dig up the root and make some tea out of it. And so that automatically gives you that connection with nature right there, or, you know, Indian cucumber root, you know, and boiling it. And, you know, there's just all kinds of interesting things that you can come across out in the wild. And then, you know, I got into high school and I was in the Future Farmers of America FFA, and I was on the agronomy judging team because, you know, I grew up on a small family farm in Ohio, and
plants at that
stage to me were about food and sustenance for people or feeding cattle, or, you know, we had a horse farm and I was big into horses and so, you know, it was more about grain and crops and things. But then, I went to Ohio State. I'm a Buckeye. And of course.
Ow. Oh, no.
Well, how appropriate is it that I go to a school named for a plant, you know, whose mascot is a plant?
A native plant.
So I think that's awesome.
I like a mascot walking around on the sidelines during the football games. He's got that big, he's got the big Buckeye head.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Oh, man. And you got a lot of red, I guess.
Oh, my goodness, Mike. It's funny you should mention that because. Like, you know, I grew up in Ohio, and my wife will go back and she'll look at pictures of me as a kid. And when I was showing horses as a kid, I had a red cowboy hat and red cowboy boots. and you know, she's looking at me like, what was wrong with you? You know, and I was like, I grew up in Ohio. Those are our colors, you know.
John, on the back of your ball cap, do you put like those Buckeye symbols?
Yeah.
On the back for everything that, when you do a good job, you get
I get another Buckeye. Yeah.
Get a Buckeye.
Yeah, that's, I think I'll incorporate that with the guys when they do a good job, I'll give them another Buckeye.
You get a Buckeye.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Sticker that goes on there. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, and then I kind of got away from agronomy in college because it was kind of a boring curricula and the teachers weren't really exciting, and so I kind of went back into horses, and I graduated with a degree in animal science, and I actually trained horses for a few years when I got out of school, and I learned some good lessons and some bad. You know, I worked with a couple by the name of Gene Hart and Bob Hart Sr. And I'm still very good friends with Jean Hart, you know, 30 some years later. And she, you know, they both were an inspiration to me in the fact that they were hard workers, you know, and again, you know, just like my grandpa Bender, you know, Mr. Hart was the first guy in the stable in the morning and he was the last guy to leave at night. And Mrs. Hart just knew, you know, exactly, you know, how to make a horse do what she wanted her to do. And so I learned a lot of hard work there, but I also got a lot of broken bones and a lot of kicks bites and I didn't make any money at all. You know, I think I worked 80 hours a week and I made $150 a week or something as a college graduate. And, you know, and I was like, this really isn't a good career move. And I needed to pay some bills. And so I dropped back and punted and took a landscaping job and ended up in, just outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania in Linhartsville and, working with a lady by the name of Joanne Kostecki, in garden design. And, you know, Joanne wasn't into natives or anything, but she was into that style of landscaping called the New American Garden that Uman van Sweden invented. And I kind of hate that term because there are no American plants in the new American garden. There's a bunch of Japanese.
But it's the style. It's that naturalistic style. That they're a little more relaxed and,
A lot of flowers.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be, native to meet the criteria on that. It's more relaxed, not that formal.
Until then, what I thought was landscaping was 5 acres of lawn and 3 ewes in front of the house. That's what I thought landscaping was. So, I owed it to her to kind of open that mind frame. And lucky for me, while I was up in Pennsylvania, my dad said, you got to go up to this place called Hawk Mountain Sanctuary. And
heard about that.
It's a beautiful place. And, that's hopefully we can get somebody from Hawk Mountain on a show sometime because, that was a very life-changing place for me because, not only did I meet my wife, Susanna, there as an intern, but I met a lady by the name of Sue Wolf, and she started the Habitat Garden up at Hawk Mountain. And so I became a volunteer in the Habitat Garden, and being a landscaper, I kept bringing plants up, and most of the time I wasn't really thinking about what I was bringing up there, and I brought up some winterberry. That winterberry bush is still there, just outside of the window at the visitor center. I can't tell you how happy I was to see it when I went up there a year or two ago. And I took up some mountain laurel, but Mike, you're gonna love this story. The one day I went up there and I took up this plant, and I said to Sue, I said, here's this beautiful plant that you should put, it likes wet feet, and it blooms most of the summer, and it's got these pretty pink blooms on it, and it was a plant known as purple loosestrife.
Oh no. But John, that used to be cool. That plant was you couldn't beat it for bloom. It was tough as nails.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we didn't know what
couldn't
it was
going
to do in the wetlands. And that, it's outlawed for in the state of Tennessee to sell, grow and sell.
Most of the East Coast,
So, and you took that to
I did. And, Sue was very kind. She didn't kick me off the mountain or anything. She said thanks, but we're trying to landscape with native plants, and this is an exotic invasive, and that was the first time I'd ever heard that that term, that plants actually could be bad for the environment. That was a shocker to me. Most of the green industry, we all think we're doing this wonderful stuff, but out there we're planting plants
because it's green. We're spreading the green, and you mean there's such thing as a bad green?
So hopefully, in our show, one of the things I'm really proud of is, you and I have known each other 25 years, I think, 30 years, something
good
like that.
Good grief. We're like 5 or 6 year olds.
Yeah. We used to play in the sand pit together.
Yeah, that was fun, John.
But, one of the things I'm most proud of that, I hope I'm speaking for you too here is that, we weren't necessarily the first people, but we were certainly at the forefront of a movement. And, I'm sure you can tell similar stories about, going, trying to explain native plants to someone and them just kind of going, get off my lawn, hippie,
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, and John, we'll say this right now, since this podcast is not video, a lot of people that know me know that I'm an old ponytail guy.
Yep.
I've got this ponytail down my back and, 60 something years old, and that's what a lot of people, I think, they associated with this new native plant movement.
Yeah,
it's a bunch of hippies, And what's cool is that you see a lot of people converting over that were growing all those mainstream plants, and in some cases, invasive exotic mainstream plants. And, and they're not, you get away from that stereotypic, they're a bunch of hippies promoting. Or they think, well, native means pot. Oh,
right.
That's native, yeah. No, this is, I'm not in Colorado.
That's another podcast.
Yeah, that's another podcast. Did you say podcast?
Yeah, that's our, that'll be a special podcast.
Podcast.
We have to find someone from the Denver Botanic Garden to host our show, and we'll have a podcast out there.
And you hear in the background. Excuse me, Justin. You know, you mentioned that you met your wife Susanna there at Hog Mountain. Was she in horticulture? I mean,
know Susanna, and you've known her a long time, and my favorite Susanna story is that she's a raptor biologist. You know, she studies birds of prey by degree,
which is why she was out Hog Mountain.
She was doing an internship studying sharp-shinned hawks and the American kestrel, as a matter of fact. And the funniest thing I think I've ever heard Susanna say is that there's two types of birds, raptors and raptor food. And I tell people that all the time, and they get the biggest kick out of that. But, you know, Susanna did her thesis in the Galapagos Islands on the Galapagos hawk. And so, you know, as we got more serious and more involved, she took me home to Ecuador. I had to meet her family and then eventually took me out to the Galapagos Islands. And, I've been out there four times now, which, you know, I'm totally blessed. The fact that I, you know, visit the Galapagos Islands for four times. And, you know, Mike, you've seen it in Tennessee. I've seen it in Virginia. There's exotic invasive plants all over the place. There's exotic invasive pests that escape cultivation. And Galapagos is just like anywhere in the world. It's under attack by introduced species. And what happens is, you know, people either fly out or they take a boat out to the Galapagos. And every time that happens, there's the chance of a new introduction.
Bringing something in. Yeah.
And so.
And not intended. No. I mean, that's a lot about this invasive exotic, you know, is that we're learning, well, the source, you know, how did it get involved here? And, you know, and then people, the guy that brought in kudzu into the South, you know, he didn't, you know. And of course now, you know, people say, wow, God, I wish he hadn't have done that. But at the time it was a fix. It was, you know, the clear cut practices of logging back then, you know, just terrible erosion and soil was just going away, you know, and, you know, this guy came in with something that fixed that. And
I have an idea.
Uh oh.
No, I said, yeah, the guy said, I've got an idea.
You scared me when you said, I have an idea. I said, we're going to do something with kudzu.
The kudzu you know, show.
Reason I asked about Susanna is that I know you've heard this story a thousand times, and so I'm going to tell you again, that, you know, if it wasn't for Paul Moore in the Garden Center, I wouldn't have met Terry, my wife. And that's, you know, and she and I, of course, you know, we have this business together. In fact, she's the president of Grow Wild Incorporated.
Yeah.
I'm the vice president, and there's a lot to be said about a woman-owned, female-owned business. But she and I, you know, it's one of those rare occurrences where, you know, husband and wife actually see eye to eye on this thing. This, you know, and if you walked around our yard right now, which she is big on this yard, there's no turf grass. There's no, you know, and
that's awesome.
You know, well, and that's not easy to do because we were born and raised with turf.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, and we were in many cases born and raised with some of those invasive exotics that lined around the turf and it was squared off and, you know, and, so she maintains this yard at the house and, you know, our house is a quarter mile up the drive from the nursery and, you know, I'll do the best I can to maintain the nursery. She does, everything else here at the house and, so kudos to my wife. I need to say that she's, you know, and she answers the phone. If you call Grow Wild Incorporated, you call the office and she answers the phone. And John, it's amazing some of the questions she gets, you know, like, well, I've been looking for some Pieris japonica. Well, it's not native. Well, what do you mean it's not native? Well, you said japonica. What is that? Japonica. Oh, do you have any junipers chinensis? Chinensis, Chinese. So, you know, so she gets to, you know, talk about the educating that we have to do in our business. She really is an in the trenches with that, because she gets all these, and that's what's great. We get phone calls about, well, what is Native?
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll have some discussions about that on a future podcast.
Definitely.
You know, really talk about what is Native. What's the idea of cultivars? And boy, I freely use cultivars and, you know, my designs right now. Not every design. We have to consider the site, but, really gets hits with that all the time. But,
well, if I can put in a good word for your Mrs. Terry there, she's been a big influence in my life as well, because I don't know if you remember this, but you, Terry, and I met for the first time back at the Millersville Native Plant Conference.
Millersville, yeah. Pennsylvania, at Millersville University in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and, that's where I met Terry, and I remember you and I talked about plants, and, you know, I just was amazed that Terry knew what she did, and, you know, she's still, you know, we talk every day on Facebook, and, you know, if I have a question about, hey, when should I divide prairie drop seed, you know, I'll shoot the question over to her, and she'll tell me exactly when to do it and how to do it, and, yeah, she's a wonderful, wonderful source of information.
And what is that program you called it? What'd you call it?
Facebook? Face Crack, I think it's called.
Wow, gosh. Is that something new?
Well, actually, since you mentioned it, we actually have a page on Facebook if you want to go on there and like us, but we'll get into that later. But I guess both of our wives have been a big influence in our lives. And
Speaking of Native Plant Conferences, Cullowhee, I mean, if people don't know about the Cullowhee Conference, man, they need to know about it. And, at Western Carolina University in the eastern part of North Carolina, in Cullowhee, in the little town of Cullowhee, right outside of western part of North Carolina, in the mountains in Appalachia, there is a conference every July at the Western Carolina University called the Cullowhee Conference.
Yep.
And it's, I would say, John, Millersville's great. There's so many other conferences, and, you know, Mount Cuba up there in Delaware, you know, they have a great one, you know. But Cullowhee just seems to be the mother of the conferences. It's, you know, and people need to know that, and, you know, you and I, of course, we attend every year. We've been attending for, 20-something, almost 30 years.
I started when I was 6. But I it's the greatest place in the world. And, you know, the funniest thing to me is, you know, you and I know all the regulars that go there, and I go for the classes, and I go to get inspired, but the other thing that I go for is just to go out into the woods with most incredible botanists.
Exactly.
That, you know, Peter Luce, George Morris, we're going to have on a show later, you know, just some incredibly knowledgeable people that are just there to have a good time. But, you know, we go up on the Blue Ridge Parkway, and there were, you know, IDN seeps that come out of the hillside, and all the different plants that grow in there. Just an amazing wealth of knowledge at your fingertips when you're at that conference. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and the people that attend, you know, they, again, you know, rule number one, don't ram this down someone's throat. But, you know, we all have that one thing in common. We really believe in this native plant movement. We really believe in it. And to talk about it and say, well, you know, it's safe. You know, it's almost like a pill where it's safe to talk about this. You know, Terry and I are going to be attending, Philadelphia Flower Show, 1st of March. And, you know, I've got friends that grow a lot of the bedding plants and, you know, that. And, you know, I can now talk with them a little bit about the native plant movement.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the old days, if it wasn't pansies and, you know, marigolds, it would, you know, what else is there? And, you know, but Cullowhee, you go and you got that one thing in common. And like you say, the environment is just, you walk around in those mountains. July.
Such a beautiful place.
Where, you know, we would have to wear a jacket because it was so cool being in the mountains in July. But, that's
all the waterfalls. What
What about some of these other places? I know you and Suzanne has been all, you've been all over the place, and, some of these other places you've gone, I guess, besides the Galapagos, and which I'm so envious. Terry and I keep saying, man, next time they're going down there, we're going to tag along with them. y'all.
Well, we keep saying we got to put together a trip because, you know, we have friends who do that. You know, you can take a boatload of 16, 20 people, and we keep thinking, you know, we need to just put it out there to our friends that we're doing this trip, and I'm sure it would fill up like nothing. But, yeah, no, you know, I guess, you know, I think what you're kind of hitting at is, you know, is this green movement happening, you know, all over the world? And I certainly see it. It's got its own interpretation in each place. You know, here on the East Coast, you and I are talking about natives and kind of how they pertain to what grew here before European colonization. But, you know, you go over to Europe and native might have a little different definition to it. You go out to California, maybe people think of it a little differently. I know you have a daughter in China. Have you ever seen mm-hmm. things over there that?
Oh yeah, it's crazy. We went to visit her. She's lives in Shanghai. Last time we went over, we actually, it's so cool, but we took a ferry to this island out in the East China Sea called Putuzhan. And Putuzhan is known for the Buddhist female monk called Guyir. And it's, you know, there's temples back in these hills. There's, you know, and it's a small island. And, you know, as you talk about the Galapagos and how vulnerable the islands are, you know, we were walking around seeing kudzu. We were walking around seeing privet. We were seeing, you know, a lot of these, what we call the invasive exotics, they were naturally occurring over there. And they were well-kept plants. I mean, they just...
Well-behaved.
You just see it out of hand. You're well-behaved. And, you know, and didn't get out of hand. There was a monastery there, a Buddhist monastery. We walked in, and there was this long obelisk of do's and don'ts, and all in Chinese calligraphy, which Ray, my daughter, you know, kind of deciphered for me. And there was one that really struck me. All I can see was one photograph of goldenrod. And that is an invasive exotic for them. Okay. Yeah. Now, of course, you know, they called it Canadian goldenrod. And of course, it's the goldenrod, the Gigantea that occurs all along the roadways here. And,
right.
You know, and it is, it's a bit of a thug in our gardens. You know, we got to be careful with that. It's pretty, pretty aggressive. But over there, it is an invasive exotic, you know. So, you know, every place has its own invasive exotics. And, you know, but you start to appreciate that once you take that plant, that privet, that cute little shrub that I saw on that island, and you take it and put it in the southeast somewhere and just watch it, you know,
boom
off. And my mother made my brother and I transplant those from an area where Interstate 40 was going through Nashville and West Nashville, and as a kid in the 60s, she would say, okay, well, they're going to tear down these houses in this neighborhood, let's go dig up some of the landscape plants and put them in our yard. You know, we were came from a poor family, and you know, there was no such thing as going to a garden center and buying this stuff, so we went and dug up privet. And we would line it in our backyard on one side, on the other, and, you know, and over the years, keep it cropped and manicured and straight and all that. You know, I mean, that was an outstanding, fast growing landscape shrub. So, this movement, this green movement that we're in, it's different now. You know, people starting to wake up and say, well, what about the birds and butterflies? You know, we know privet's not good for the birds, especially the migratory birds.
Yeah, there's a lot more awareness of, you know, man's impact on the natural world. And, you know, we're a vector of change is what it simply is. And, you know, as we're jet setting across the world, we're dragging along stragglers with us. So, well, Mike, I think we should probably cut it short there. And, you know, I've learned a lot about you today, of course, and hopefully, you're not shocked by the things I've said, so.
I've heard you say a lot worse, John.
But we do have a couple of questions that, we got from our readers that, I thought we'd answer, and, I'll take the first one. This is from Sean in Columbus, Ohio, home of the Ohio State Buckeyes.
I wish you quit saying that.
You will never hear me not plug the Buckeyes. So, but he says, two things. One, how do I follow the podcast? And, you know, Sean, that's probably the most important question that a person could ask right now. So basically, everything, well, first off, we have a webpage, nativeplantpodcast.com. Our good friend Jesse Turner, who's the kind of the third member of our team and what we're call our tech guy, helped us set up that webpage. So just go to nativeplantpodcast.com and you can listen to the show there. You can download it and listen to it later in MP3 format. We also hope to, you know, get it up on iTunes so that, you know, if you have an iPod, I've got an iPod that I use when I walk my dogs, and I've got three or four shows that I listen to during that time. And so hopefully we'll figure that out and be able to do that. But right now we've got a Facebook page, and I think that's the easiest place for Mike and I to interact. Yeah, I think that's the easiest place for us to interact with people who are listening to the show and have questions or suggestions for shows that they want to see or guests they'd like to hear. So just go to Facebook, do a search for Native Plant Podcast. It should take you right to our page. Like it, and, you know, anytime we update anything, it should let you know.
And, you know, if there's more questions, I mean, you know, we're looking to...
We love questions.
There's going to be a lot of people... We love questions. And no, it doesn't matter how crazy, how far out there they are, you know.
There are no stupid questions.
There are no stupid questions. You know, so yeah, that's get onto the, you know, to the Facebook page. Wait, and what's that program called again?
Facebook.
Okay, I'm going to learn how to do that. Say, you know, is it easy to get?
I've heard. I don't know anything about it myself, but so Sean has another question. I have a grapevine. I love it, but I can't keep the birds and the critters from eating all the grapes. What can I do?
Well,
Sean, guess what? You know that, what's that old Kevin Costner movie, Mike? The Field of Dreams?
Yeah. Field of Dreams.
If you build it, they will come.
They will come.
Sean, you just built a critter smorgasbord. And
it's
so,
a buffet line. You need to put a cup out front there, you know, Sean, and charge as they come before they start eating. But here's, you know, and I've seen this. You probably have clients that had the same situation before up there, John. But, you know, if you put other food out there, which is a lot of these other native, are a lot of these other native plants. And, you know, they you know, if that's all you've got to feed them with, well, sure, you know, and, but chokeberry, black chokeberry is an excellent bird food. High in vitamin C. It's, and, you know, good for the migratory birds as they're flying south and they want to eat some of that that's in the late summer, fall. And, so put some other food out there, you know, they can eat. So,
put some native plants out there.
Well, I've got a question here too, John. This is, from Susie Cat in Tennessee. And here's what she says. She says, stinging nettle is supposed to be prolific in East Tennessee and found it at the edge of the woods or partly shaded areas, correct? And that is very correct, Susie Cat. She says, we have 4 acres of partly wooded land surrounded by woods. Either we don't have any growing or I'm having a really hard time identifying this plant. I've looked at many pics and drawings, but when you're out there, and she put quotation marks around there, hunting, it is out there, which, you know, described us, you know. It is quite more difficult to see. When is nettle green and growing, and what are its favorite growing conditions? Where would I most likely find it? And she signs it as perplexed. Thank you. Well, Susie Cat, if you're having a hard time finding, here's what you do in the summer. Take all your clothes off, run through a large patch that looks like it's about 5 or 6 feet tall, and if your body is on fire, you probably found stinging nettle, okay? But I'm guessing that what she's talking about is the urtica, which is, by the way, is not just a North American native species. It occurs through Eurasia as well.
Yeah.
And for thousands of years, people have been using the young leaves as a pot herb and, you know, cooking, and it's got all kinds of medicinal properties. And but stinging nettle, very easy to find in the summer. Now, in the winter, because it doesn't have any evergreen basil growth, you'll have a hard time finding it. Yeah. Unless you can really figure out the seed heads from the fall. But if you take the leaves in the summer and turn it upside down, you're going to see these little bristles along the midribs of the underneath the leaf, and they are actually hypodermic needles.
Yeah.
And what they do is that when they touch your skin, they will exude this folic acid, and that's where the burning comes from. So yeah. I hope that answers your question, Susie Cat. Run naked through the woods and you'll find the stinging nettle.
I like that suggestion, Mike. So
you don't do that, John?
I'm not. I know what stinging nettle looks like. I steer clear of it. But so our next section of the show, you know, Mike and I love our dogs, and we call this Wag the Dog, and you know, we're each gonna have a dog story, and Mike, as you know, I've got two dogs. Emma is a Welsh Corgi and just a pistol. And Chewie, or Chewbacca, is his full name, is an Australian Shepherd, and
Aussie.
They're both fantastic dogs, but Emma's the boss, and she's hilarious because she will tell you exactly what you should be doing all the time, just like a good herding dog is supposed to do. She will direct you as to what you are doing. And so she has a toy, you know, that you are supposed to throw. And she won't, you know, like Chewie has 15, 20 different toys that he knows every one of them by name. If you say, go get Boba Fett, he goes and gets Boba Fett. If you say, go get the football, he goes and gets the football. Emma is not that complex. She's very simple, very, you know, this is my toy and you are supposed to throw it because I'm barking at you and you're supposed to throw it. And so Emma has a bad leg. And so we have to limit her exercise, but we went to the vet on Saturday and put her on some new meds, and she seems to really be responding well to it, and she's not as lame anymore. And so I came home tonight, Mike, it's, you know, like 2 degrees outside, and Emma's like barking at me to throw a toy. And usually what I'll do is throw it 3 or 4 times and then she's satisfied and I can move on with my life. And so tonight I threw it 3 times, and you know, I was getting ready for this recording, and so I'm walking in, I had to feed him, and so I'm like, come on, you know, puppy chow, and she's standing out in the yard with this toy in her mouth, and she's like going, oof, oof, oof. So I guess I wasn't done throwing the toy, and I had to go back and throw the toy 2 or 3 more times. She's hilarious.
I can see that.
She is hilarious.
Oh, we love our dogs.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've got Wesley, which is also an Aussie, an Australian Shepherd. And, you know, God, we love our dogs. We also have Amy, which is a great Pyrenees mix. And of course, Amy is nocturnal and barks all night and sleeps all day. And that's, you know, but Wesley, I know we've told you this before, but Wesley has a terrible underbite. And in fact, we took him to the vet when he was young, and the vet says, you're not going to show this dog, are you? And, you know, he's a full-blooded, you know, Australian Shepherd. And I said, why? He looks beautiful to me. He said, well, look. And, you know, he has this terrible over. Well, so here's what happens. If something falls, a piece of cheese, he loves cheese, you know, and every once in a while something falls on the floor. Watch him try to pick that up, you know, with that terrible underbite, you know. And you could stick your finger between his bottom teeth and his top teeth. That's how much underbite, overbite he has, you know. But, yeah, we love our dogs.
Do you have to do anything special to feed him, or he can eat okay and everything? Or
he likes soft food, but then again, so do I. So,
So you guys get along just fine.
Yeah.
We got to post a picture on the Facebook page of Wesley with his legs up in the air on your lap. I think that's just the greatest thing. I see those pictures and I'm just like, let me pet that dog.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you like to lay like that, John?
Oh,
not
yeah.
on my lap, but I mean, not on my
Maybe
lap.
On Terry's. I'd be okay with that.
Well,
so
wrapping up here, John, I learned a lot today. I want to tell you what I learned. And, you know, every time that you and I talk, I learn a little bit more from you. Here's what I learned. Now I know why you and Susanna are together, because she did the raptor studies. And she must saw something in you that was something about a raptor. And, you know, there's so many jokes in there. I'm going to write them all down.
We'll be posting them on the page later.
Yeah.
Well, I learned Terry's your boss, and I'll constantly remind you of that. But, you know, next week we're going to have the third member of our team on, Jesse Turner. And Jesse's an expert in children's gardens, so if you want to learn about children's gardens and native plants, be sure to tune in or download the show. And, Mike, it's time for our favorite part of the show.
Oh, favorite part. Okay. Here we go, John. I got something here. I want you to hear this.
Okay. Oh. Uh-oh. Okay.
And, yeah. And, you know, I like my beer in a glass. So.
Oh, yeah. It's the only way to drink it. Oh, music to my ears.
Yeah, I've just poured myself a Brew Wild. I'm not going to promote my homebrew too much, but it's a Brew Wild called Hop Rod, Hop Rod. And it's a real hoppy beer. And here it is, you know, single digit night, and I'm drinking not a stout or a porter. I'm drinking a hoppy beer. I mean, it's an IPA. Imperial IPA that I brewed, and man, it's already burning my eyes. Oh man. Ooh, I think it just burned my mustache off.
You know, Mike, while you're
what have you got?
You're enjoying that sip, I'll let me you know, the only way to drink beer is in a glass, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. I always say there's nothing like good head on a beer.
What are you drinking, John?
I am drinking a Weyerbacher Blithering Idiot Ale. And, and I really like it. It's a Brandywine Ale. So a little bit different taste to it. Pretty high gravity. I think it's like 7% alcohol or something. But, so Mike, here's to you. You know, here's to you, buddy.
Here's to you, John. Yeah. Great podcast.
Great podcasting. And join us next time, and we'll see you on the flip side.
See you later.